16th, 1859, firebrand abolitionist John Brown led a group of 18 men in an attack on the U.S. arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. The purported mission was to start a slave revolt. After a day and a half of savage fighting, Brown was captured and later hanged. His raid and death divided an already divided country. Our guest Tony Horwitz says that Brown's actions led to the election of Abraham Lincoln and the president's decision to declare war on the South. Horwitz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of a new book called Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Congratulations on your book, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Does he still divide a divided nation, John Brown?
Absolutely. He's perhaps the most divisive figure in our history. There's very little middle ground with John Brown. He tends to be viewed as either a hero and martyr or a murderous monster. And I was in Harper's Ferry a few days ago where there are zillions of school kids all the time, and I was talking to a park ranger who talks to the kids. And at the end of the program, they have the kids vote on whether what John Brown did was right or wrong, and he says it almost always splits 50-50.
Wow.
So even kids kind of get that this guy really splits us down the middle.
Does he split you down the middle as well?
He did. One reason I wanted to write the book is I was a little frustrated in reading earlier biographies that he seems to drive historians crackers. By the end of the book, most of them either wish they were there charging into Harper's Ferry with him or fitting the noose around his neck on the gallows. And I wanted to really try and tell his story in all its complexity, not try and fit him into some preconceived mold, and leave it to readers to decide. I hope part of the suspense of reading the book is figuring out how you feel about him, because I certainly struggled with that while writing the book.
Described as a shoot-to-kill abolitionist, and that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Exactly. Most abolitionists in this era were staunch pacifists, many of them here in Philadelphia, who believed that education and moral uplift was the way to defeat slavery. Brown derided this as what he called milk-and-water abolitionism, weak and ineffectual. To him, slavery is a state of war and must be met in kind and by force.
He was raised in a Calvinist family, and as you describe, a family that believed in sin, and that sin should be punished. Were his parents also abolitionists?
His father was. His mother died in childbirth when he was only 8, so we don't know a great deal about her. But his father was, yes, a staunch Calvinist, really almost a throwback to that old Puritan belief from Connecticut. Fixated by our lights on sin and the depravity of human nature, and that sin must be rooted out, both personal and collective sin. And of course, slavery was the great collective sin of the nation. So he was an early abolitionist. And in many ways, John Brown, though he becomes an insurrectionist, is a bit of a conformist in following his father into the same trade, the same beliefs. His father is a very formative influence on him.
And his family at a time was a stop on the Underground Railroad, so they weren't just talking the talk. They were
right.
They were doing it.
His father was active in the Underground Railroad. John Brown himself, as a young man, his father later becomes an early trustee of Oberlin, which is this radical new college, one of the first to accept blacks and women. So they're really at the forefront in northern Ohio of this early abolitionist movement.
You describe him seeing a young, I guess it was a teenage slave, being beaten with shovels.
Right.
But this was a formative experience for him.
Yeah, towards the end of his life, he writes a long letter that's referred to as his autobiography about his childhood. And he claims in it that at the age of 12, he saw a slave boy in Ohio, because there was still slavery in the North at that time, beaten with an iron shovel, and that this led him to declare eternal war on slavery. I'm sure he remembered it that way, but I think it's more complicated than that. I think the influence of his father and many aspects of his character and upbringing fed this this burning passion to overthrow slavery, not simply one event in his life.
Is there any way to know 150 years or more than 150 years later what he was like?
Yeah, we're very fortunate in that Brown and his family and his accomplices left a very long paper trail. They wrote scores and scores of letters that survive. And thankfully, as a researcher, Brown's handwriting is quite clear. And he writes with a really wonderful sort of eloquence and plainness. So we really can get a great deal of insight into his character, both through his own writing, but also, of course, that of many people who knew him.
And you don't want to psychologize someone too much, but he did seem to have these mood swings.
Yeah, this is a question that always comes up with Brown. You know, was he insane? And at his trial, his defense lawyers try and bring an insanity defense, and he wants no part of it. And, you know, I looked at this. This is a tricky issue because I think insanity is a way really to dismiss him then and now, to say, oh, he's just this crazy lone gunman. We don't really have to think about him too seriously. So I think it's a mistake to focus on it too much, but I do think it's fair to say he was an obsessive character, almost an Ahab, for whom the white whale is slavery. His behavior, yes, could be a bit erratic. But, you know, one, that's true of many important characters through history. Lincoln was severely depressed, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, many others. So I don't think it really, it's interesting as a biographical point, but I don't think he was clinically insane. He knew exactly what he was doing and what the consequences were.
And he seemed to draw inspiration from Old Testament, from Gideon, for instance.
Right. Yeah, I mean, while researching book, I have to say I had the Bible at my side. Every one of his letters has a biblical allusion. And it's interesting because he identifies strongly, particularly with Old Testament characters, and he sort of cycles through a number of different ones in the course of his life. Gideon, who blows his trumpet and leads a small band against the wicked Midianites, is one model. Moses, leading slaves to freedom. At one point, he actually frees and leads slaves to Canada. Clearly a Moses identification. And at the end, I think Samson, bringing down the pillars of slavery with himself in the ruins. There are others, but those are, I would say, the principal ones.
You talk about the influence that his father had, and his mother died in childbirth when he was still pretty young. Any way to know what impact that had on him? And, of course, dying in childbirth was not that unusual in those days.
Right. It was horribly common. Yeah, he writes about it very frankly in this autobiographical letter late in life, and he describes it as a loss from which he never recovered, and that even though his father quickly remarried to what John Brown describes as an estimable woman, he says he never embraced her with his heart and pined for his own mother for years. And part of what makes this so poignant is then his first wife also dies young in childbirth, and you can see him really, he doesn't state it, but, you know, echoes this tragedy revisited, really. It seems to send him into shock. You read his letters and you say he is really suffering, as anyone would, but I think in his case even more deeply because of his own mother.
And does he question God? I mean, I can't imagine that he would with the kind of beliefs that he had. But
He never does, at least in his writing, and which, you know, is remarkable. Not only does he lose his first wife, he has 20 children in the course of his life, 9 of whom die before the age of 10. One of whom is scalded to death by accident by an older sister. So he's constantly burying kids. 3 sons will later die fighting with him against slavery. So, you know, he endures tremendous personal tragedy. So Job really would be another figure that I think he identified with at stages. But he has this burning passion that sustains him through all this, you know, which is his belief that it's his God-given destiny to overthrow slavery.
He, in fact, moves his family to Kansas, in a sense, to stake a claim against slavery.
In the mid-1850s, Kansas is sort of the front line in the conflict over slavery in the country. It's just been open to settlement, and the debate is whether it will enter the Union as a free or slave state. And actually, Brown's sons go there before him. He, at this point, he's in his mid-50s. He's had this failed business career. He's gone bankrupt. He's really a failure in many ways. He goes to join his sons and sort of, you know, mans the ramparts in this fight, which up to that point, the South is winning. And Brown is the rare Northerner who punches back hard and really takes on the pro-slave forces. And this is really when he emerges as a militant abolitionist.
In fact, there's a controversial attack that he leads at Pottawatomie Creek.
Right. This is one of the most perplexing, troubling, and important moments of Brown's career. In 1856, the South has been, or Southern forces have been killing and intimidating settlers in Kansas who wanted to be a free state. And Brown finally strikes back and leads a party in the night to a pro-slave settlement, Pottawatomie, drags five men from their beds and hacks them to death with broadswords. This is a shocking act, and it has really its desired effect. Southerners finally realize, oh my gosh, you know, we can't do this with abandon. There's going to be reprisal. And it also really sparks a broad conflict in Kansas. This is the point at which it becomes Bleeding Kansas, as it's known. He really lights the fire there. So he then fights in open field battle.
And how does he justify that? Hacking people to death.
He was a little evasive in what he said and wrote about this incident. You know, he said, God is my judge, and under the circumstances, I was justified. He never really said more than that. His children kind of tried to talk around it, that he was there, but he didn't actually shed blood. But I think he wanted to really strike terror into the hearts of Southerners in Kansas, really to evoke the Nat Turner slave rebellion of 1831, when slaves in Virginia murdered whites in their beds. This was a very potent fear among Southerners, and I think he wanted to evoke that with this nighttime raid.
And he got, in a sense, he got away with that, right?
Well, he immediately became a wanted man in Kansas, posses coming after him. He's chased by both federal forces and these sort of ill-organized pro-slave forces. He then, though, fights in open field battle. I think it's often forgotten that 5 years before the Civil War, you have Northerners and Southerners in Kansas killing each other over slavery in open field battle with musket and cannon. This is in some ways a preview, at least, of the Civil War.
And we're almost up in a break here, but Kansas, I guess, deciding whether to be a slave state or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the sort of critical issue.
Right. The westward expansion of slavery was really what people were engaged with in this at this point.
And that's Tony Harwitz, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about John Brown, the controversial abolitionist, and he's written a book about Brown and his time called Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. Of course, the raid at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. We're going to take a very short break and talk more about events leading up to Harper's Ferry. And we're going to take some calls, hopefully, at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, help celebrate the music and culture of Turkey and France at an Orient Express party featuring belly dancing, gypsy jazz, and a round of can-can dancing from Turkish and French performers, beginning at 5:45. More details are available at philamuseum.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY.
Newsworks.org is your source for smart stories that keep you better informed, better connected, and better prepared. Our network of quality journalists is a step above the rest, and better coverage of important issues means you'll always be a step ahead. Newsworks is something different. News for people who ask more. News for people who care, by people who care. Get involved at Newsworks.org. Newsworks is, simply, news that works. Powered by WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Cancer prevention and early detection begin with knowing your risk and then doing something about it. This year, Fox Chase's risk assessment program celebrates its 20th anniversary, and Fox Chase offers a full range of screening options, including genetic testing. Regular screening is an opportunity to give your loved ones the gift of peace of mind. More details on their Facebook page. Regular cancer screening, the gift that keeps living. Fox Chase, hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Tony Horwitz. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of a new book about John Brown called Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. And we are retelling some of this history and hoping to understand or maybe come to some kind of a conclusion about whether John Brown was a hero, a madman, a terrorist, a saint. It's a question that has dogged him for the last 150 years. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. So why did he pick Harper's Ferry, this U.S. Arsenal, Harper's Ferry? Why, of all places, was this the place where he was going to organize his raid?
Right. For he picked Harper's Ferry really for several reasons. One, if you look at a map, it's quite close to the Mason and Dixon line, so you can have a sort of easy supply line to the north. Two, it's in the mountains. And Brown was really fixated on this notion of a mountain-based revolution, that he was going to begin freeing and arming slaves and retreat to the mountains and then sort of move south along the Appalachians deeper into the south, this sort of rolling campaign of liberation. And three, it has this enormous federal arsenal. There are only two of them in the nation at this time, 100,000 guns at Harper's Ferry. Mm. Now, my own feeling is he does this as much for shock value as he does for logistical or military reasons. I'm not sure he really needs or wants those guns. In fact, he doesn't touch them in the time he's there. But he wants to strike this symbol of American power just 60 miles from Washington in the largest slave state in the country and really, you know, wake up the nation, which he does.
Would you say he declared war on the United States? Was it a declaration of war?
In a sense, he invades a federal facility, takes over these guns or takes control of them, and declares that he's there to free every slave in the South. He also, interestingly, since we're here in Philadelphia, writes his own constitution. He plans, he's a very ambitious man, and he plans a real government that he's going to have in the mountains, and writes this constitution modeled on the U.S. one, except that all citizens, all blacks are citizens and fully equal, as are women. This is a very radical document for its day.
And the idea was to inspire a slave revolt. Was that what he was thinking, or he would lead a slave revolt against the country?
Yeah, I think his feeling was that slaves would flock to his liberating force, come with him to the mountains, and that he would make slavery insecure, is the way he put it, that in a sense he would undermine it economically. He never said explicitly a slave revolt, but, you know, it amounted to that.
Sure.
That was his hope.
What I found interesting is a number of people commenting on how he treated black people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming some abolitionists were rather patronizing. Yeah. He was not that way. He lived easily with them, saw them, really did see them as equals.
Yeah, Brown is a remarkably progressive man. Abolitionists, while wanting to end slavery, as you said, were often quite condescending towards blacks, thought they were too docile and inferior to fight for their own freedom, you know, leave it to us. Brown said, nonsense. Blacks and whites need to fight together. Blacks lived in his home. He lived in black homes at times. And he has five black men in his band. And one of them writes that there was really no sense of difference. So he was deeply unusual in that way. He even says later in prison, he's asked about how he feels about interracial marriage.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I don't really think I'm for it, but you know what? I would rather my daughters marry an industrious black man than a lazy white man. Well, you know, 1859, that's a pretty radical thing to say.
You also quote Frederick Douglass, who he consulted, I guess, mm-hmm. about this raid on Harper's Ferry. And Douglass says all his arguments and all his descriptions of the place convinced me that he was going into a perfect steel trap and that once he got in, he would never get out alive. people advised against this raid.
Yeah, Brown and Douglas have this 15-year dance. Brown really wants Douglas, this great orator and abolitionist and former slave, fugitive slave, to join his cause. And in the end, Douglas comes close. He supports him but won't go with him because, as you read, he sees that it's a doomed attack. And others do as well. And this is why Harriet Tubman, another one who Brown seeks her support, doesn't appear either. I think blacks recognize really what he's up against, and also that if they were to go with him, their chances were you know, dire indeed.
Well, he led 18 men against this arsenal.
Right. And in the end, only one of them really escapes death or hanging. One of the black raiders makes it back to Canada.
He also has this group, the Secret Six, and these you're smiling because these were characters, yes?
Yeah.
To say the least.
I mean, this is, you know, what's interesting about Brown, you know, you get into all these different worlds, and he had these core supporters in the North, known as the Secret Six, who, despite their name, that name, were very prominent public men.
They're
two of the richest businessmen in the North, transcendentalists, ministers, reformers. And they're funneling him money and guns. And there's a fascinating sort of relationship because Brown, they're playing each other. Brown plays on them as this rough-hewn warrior. He really wows them. One person writes that Brown was the manliest man I've ever seen. And others write about his moral magnetism. He knows how to stir their conscience and get them to give money. On the other hand, they're playing him. They want him to go do this thing, but when it goes badly, they run for the hills. Four of them go to Canada, or three of them go to Canada. One is already overseas, and another one checks into an insane asylum to avoid prosecution.
Wow. John Cook is this kind of, he's wooing women, right?
Right. Well, yeah, John Cook is one of Brown's raiders, who are also this colorful band of individuals. And Cook is one of my favorites. He's this well-bred Connecticut Yankee trained for the law, but who's got this adventurous streak. And he goes to Kansas and becomes an abolitionist fighter and crack shot. But he's also this curly-haired, blue-eyed charmer who writes florid poetry. And a year before the raid, he goes to Harper's Ferry as a spy. And he's so good at this that he charms his way into the homes and plantations of Virginians, even marries a local girl.
Wow.
And they have no idea that he's there plotting an attack on their town.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Tony Horwitz, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about John Brown and the raid on Harper's Ferry, the U.S. Arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, which happened in the fall of 1859. His book is called Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So was this, I don't want to say a suicide mission, but a failed mission from the start?
I personally feel this was a doomed mission in military terms. It was wildly ambitious to begin with, to think with that small a band you could pull this off. But also Brown didn't take the steps necessary to give it any chance of success. He didn't alert slaves ahead of time. He didn't bring wagons to carry off these guns. He didn't really have a mountain base to retreat to. So I think he all along recognized that this may well be, as you said, almost a suicide mission, but that too would succeed, that really it was a win-win. Either he would pull off this extraordinary scheme or he would die a martyr in this shocking attack and bring on the great conflict that he felt was necessary to end slavery.
So how many people died in this raid?
10 of his men are killed in action in this brutal fighting in Harper's Ferry. 7 of them are eventually captured, some of them wounded, and then hanged. And then there are 5 people on the other side fighting Brown who are killed. And there are also 2 slaves who die, who are caught up with Brown's force, who die, one in the fighting and one in prison.
And just to add to the drama here, the Marines led by Robert E. Lee, you break down the door of the arsenal, in a sense.
Right. It's remarkable, the other side in this conflict. It's almost a dress rehearsal for the Confederacy. You have Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart leading U.S. Marines, because at this point they're still loyal U.S. officers, against Brown. Stonewall Jackson and John Wilkes Booth appear later on the scene. Jefferson Davis is leading the charge in Congress, future president of the Confederacy, saying, "We will dissever the ties that bind us, even if it rushes us into a sea of blood." So, you know, the cast of characters is just stunning. And then, of course, Lincoln and many others become embroiled as well.
What was John Wilkes Booth doing there?
He was an actor, of course, and he sees troops rushing off from Richmond to repel this attack, and he's intrigued, and he just sort of jumps on the train with them and borrows a uniform. He wants to be there. So he ends up being a soldier guarding the gallows when Brown is hanged.
What was the reaction, maybe even the press reaction to this attack at Harper's Ferry?
Right. It's an interesting media story because this is an era in which the telegraph has recently been introduced. Unlike our own era, newspapers are on the rise and wire services. So this is one of the first breaking news stories in the nation. You have correspondents rushing to the scene immediately and sending, you know, breathless dispatches. So, you know, you can almost get blow-by-blow coverage, and it's quite fascinating to read. Not all of it reliable.
Right.
Many papers were either pro-Southern or pro-North, or, you know, pro-abolitionist. You have to sort of read them carefully, but you do have these very detailed news dispatches. The story essentially goes viral in our contemporary parlance. It's all over. It's being read all over the nation.
And do you see this as the unofficial beginning of the Civil War?
Yeah,
can we go that far?
Well, you know, technically, no. The Civil War begins with the shots on Fort Sumter, but I think after John Brown and his raid, there's really no going back. Up to that point, I think there's still a notion that the country can continue to compromise and muddle along. Yes, we're divided. But he really exposes how wide that divide is and greatly deepens it and really forces people to take sides. That's what he does more than anything. Today is actually the anniversary of his great speech in the courtroom on his sentence of death. And he essentially says, you know, slavery on one side, God and justice on the other. Which side are you on? And I think it's really a pivotal moment in the road to civil war.
You had mentioned that he did not use the insanity defense. And frankly, I didn't know there was
right.
an insanity defense that could have been used back at that time.
It's a great legal story as well. It's really a court drama. This was a fairly recent defense, and it had been used successfully just months before a congressman shoots his wife's lover dead in Washington and gets off on, well, actually sort of temporary insanity. But it had been around for about 15 years, that defense, and Brown's lawyers try and raise it. And he says, no, you know, I'm sane. I knew what I was doing. He really doesn't want that to happen. I think at this point he's embracing his martyrdom.
Would it be fair to say that he might have done more for his cause as a prisoner than he did as an abolitionist fighting against slavery?
It's to me the greatest irony of this story is that Brown, who's this, you know, action, you know, words aren't going to do it, thinks of himself as a great warrior, fails terribly in his action, and ultimately triumphs through his words. Mm. So yes, I really think it's his time in prison and court and on the gallows that lead to his, you know, legendary role and image to this day.
And his eloquence in speaking out against slavery.
Yeah, he had a way of essentially cutting through all the cant and all the fog and talk of compromise and making it, you know, very plain. And one thing he says that's very striking in that courtroom speech he gave on November 2nd is that, you know, not only is slavery a sin, but to not oppose it is a mm-hmm. crime. Therefore, what I did was not wrong, but right. And if that means I have to hang and mingle my blood with my sons and all the slaves in this country, so let it be done. You know, he embraces this role and really puts people on the spot. Which side are you on? Not only are you opposed to slavery, well, if you are, why aren't you doing something about it?
Can I have you read Brown's last prophecy?
Yeah. I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed it might be done."
And he was correct.
Yeah, in a sense, this is a note he passes to one of his jailers before going to the gallows, saying, you know, we need a blood sacrifice, that only a bloodbath really is going to end this. In a sense, he is prophesizing the Civil War, which erupts 18 months later.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. You'll have to stick your headphones on there. And we have Henry joining us from Lower Merion. Henry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Tony. How are you?
Good.
When Stonewall Jackson was a professor at VMI, didn't he write an account of the hanging of John Brown?
Yes, he does, and I quote it in the book. It's quite striking. In some ways, Stonewall Jackson and Brown are similar figures. They're both deeply religious men who feel it's their destiny to fight over this issue. What's interesting is Jackson, even though he loathes Brown's cause, is quite admiring of Brown's demeanor on the gallows. He just, as he describes it, faces death without flinching. And, of course, this is what Jackson is going to become famous for in battle.
Okay, Henry?
What did Jackson say to you?
What's that?
What did Jackson say in his account?
What did he say in his account?
He says essentially that, with stunning bravery, this abolitionist who he, opposes ascended the gallows and went to his death with great bravery, without a flinch. So really, I have the exact words in the book, but in essence, that's what he says. He's quite admiring of Brown's courage.
Henry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. If there hadn't been a John Brown, would we have had a Abraham Lincoln, do you think?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's a bit complicated, but this happens, this raid, in the early days of a presidential campaign. And at this point, Lincoln is really a second-tier candidate for the Republican nomination. He's not well-known nationally. And he really uses Brown as a foil. He says, this is not what the Republican Party is about. We're not about violence. We're not about meddling with slavery in the South. We're about opposing its expansion. And he essentially uses that to position himself as the safely moderate choice for Republicans in these very troubled times. So I think it contributes strongly to him getting the nomination. It also divides the opposition, the Democratic Party, which sort of breaks up between its radical Southern and more moderate Northern wing, which paves the way to Lincoln's election in the general election. So I think you could argue that without John Brown, we might not have had Lincoln.
And not to get too carried away here, but also paves the way for, in a sense, the war that Lincoln then declares on the South.
Well, sure, in that it promotes secession. Ultimately, Brown and Lincoln are kind of the 1-2 punch. It's after Lincoln's election that it's really gone, and the South quickly begins, Southern states begin to secede. What's striking is that Lincoln, who has essentially opposed Brown and is a very reluctant emancipator, essentially ends up fulfilling Brown's mission. And by the end of the war, he's really embraced Brown's approach that, sadly, only this bloodshed could do this, could force us to right this great wrong.
Well, we're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation with our guest, Tony Horwitz. And we are again talking about John Brown and the raid that sparked the Civil War. That's a subtitle to his new book. It's called Midnight Rising. He won a Pulitzer Prize for journalism. And we are talking about John Brown and what led him to do what he did and the fact that he still divides people today. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Since 1799, Westtown has invited students pre-K through grade 12 to pursue a life-size education, one that helps to prepare each student for what comes next, not only for college and career, but for a whole life. You can learn more by attending Westtown's open house on Saturday, November 12th at 10 a.m. Details at westtown.edu. Westtown School, a life-size education.
2 years after the death of Joan Didion's husband, just after she completed a memoir about grieving, Didion lost her daughter. Now Didion's written a memoir about her daughter's death. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Joan Didion, and we hear from British actor Bill Nye, co-star of the BBC movie Page 8 that airs Sunday on PBS. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Are there too many administrators in higher education? A professor says yes, and the layers of bureaucracy come at the expense of learning. Also, backgrown in, fracking, new words for the new American Heritage Dictionary. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Tony Horowitz about John Brown and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tony, about 2 years ago, you wrote an interesting op-ed in the New York Times and it's titled The 9/11 of 1859. But looking at some interesting parallels between the terror attacks of September 11th and what John Brown did in Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, there are some striking parallels. You have 19 men on this essentially suicide mission, striking a symbol of American power, led by a religious fundamentalist that leads the nation into war. So in that sense, there are some very striking parallels, and I really do think Brown intended to sow terror and shock with his attack. On the other hand, I think it's a mistake to think of Brown as a terrorist in the way we've come to. Usually Islamic militants or domestic bombers who kill indiscriminately thousands of innocents. Brown didn't do that. His attacks were very targeted. He had a clear aim, the overthrow of slavery. And by comparison to recent incidents, the body count was quite small. So I don't think we should paint him with the same brush.
But it does raise that you know, perennial ends justify means debate.
Yeah, I think Brown, in a sense, is a great teaching tool or debating point because he raises these questions. Is violence ever justified in the cause of freedom or cause of justice? I mean, right. I think we would all agree today that he was on the right side of history in opposing slavery, yet he used violence to achieve that. How should we feel about that? When does an individual have the right to defy their government and say, this is a wicked government and God or my conscience drives me to do this? So I think he raises these eternal questions that have no easy answers.
Mm. I mean, is that where you stand on him, which is just that this was an extraordinarily complicated man, mm-hmm. used very controversial methods in a just cause?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that. You know, in some ways he's quite admirable. His willingness to take on the great moral issue of his day, despite his many worldly troubles, and his conviction that, you know, slavery had to be taken on with force. But yes, of course, his violence is very troubling. And I think one of the most interesting things is the way he's been embraced by extremes on both left and right. Here's a man who has been held up as an icon by anarchists and Black Panthers and the Weathermen in the 60s and early 70s, and also by, in more recent decades, anti-abortion bombers and Timothy McVeigh. So he sets a troubling example that can be used in many different ways.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Ted from Wilmington to join us on Radio Times. And Ted, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Mr.
Horowitz, I visited Harper's Ferry this time last year, just gorgeous, about 2 hours from Philadelphia. I encourage everyone to go. Can you please give me the historical context of why the arsenal was so far out in the boondocks back in those days? Was it to give it a secure location? Because it was way out there.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Thanks, Ted.
Yeah, Harper's Ferry is, in a sense, a character in this story, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. I love Harper's Ferry, and it's got a very rich history. It's really because of George Washington. He's the one who establishes these two federal armories, one in Springfield, Massachusetts, and he chooses the other because he thinks at that point in the nation's history, it's sort of midway between North and South, and he saw it as also sort of the gateway to the West at that time. He had great ambitions for the Potomac. He thought it was going to be this sort of corridor of commerce. So he didn't see it as terribly isolated, but he liked that it was walled by mountains. So he said, as he put it, inaccessible by any enemy. And he was thinking, of course, of foreign troops invading, not of internal enemies.
Exactly. You have worked as a journalist, and I'm assuming part of journalism is being in a place so that you can write about it. When you're writing history, is that true as well?
Yeah. Most of my research was in the archives, including here in Philadelphia. The Historical Society of Pennsylvania has a brilliant Brown collection. But I also used the Archive of the Feet. I love going to the places where history happened, walking the ground, trying to get those details. And this story offers wonderful opportunities for that because it's largely intact. Brown's Mountain Hideout in Maryland, 5 miles from Harper's Ferry, still stands. The Armory Engine House, the courthouse where he was tried. And yeah, I took a night march, as Brown's men did,
on
the 150th anniversary from his mountain hideout into Harper's Ferry, to just kind of get the atmosphere and you know, feel I could describe the scene more vividly.
Through the woods and through the...
On a country road, sort of between fog-shrouded hills and, you know, the behind a horse-drawn wagon. I was with a park historian and, you know, we could hear the rush of the Potomac and see the distant lights of Harper's Ferry. And, you know, it's not, I wouldn't call it time travel, but I did, I think, allow me to perhaps get my head inside this scene. And I chose to start the book with that moment in this event.
And what's your interest in the Civil War?
I've been a Civil War nut since I was a kid.
Is that right?
And I don't, you know, I think I got it from my father and also my great-grandfather, who lived to be over 100, so I knew him as a child. We're both obsessed with the Civil War, and I was sort of the last of three children, the only one who showed any interest in it. So I think they both sort of glommed onto me. I got all the books and all the tours of the battlefield.
But it worked, right?
It worked. It's always fascinated me. But I found this an interesting moment to step out outside the 1861 to 65 period and kind of, you know, a look at the bigger question of how was it that we came to slaughter each other by the hundreds of thousands in the first place. I think we're still struggling with that question.
But one of the things you say, which I found interesting, and this is before the Civil War, is just what a powerhouse the South was.
Exactly.
How influential the South was.
Yeah, I think because we look back at the Old South through the prism of its loss in the Civil War, it has this aura of lost cause and underdog, and that somehow slavery and the plantation economy were destined to sort of wilt away on their own. This wasn't at all the case. It certainly wasn't how Americans saw it in the 1850s. Cotton was, you know, an engine of the national and global economy. It was booming. Slavery was on the march, and politically, the South controlled the government for almost the entire era between the nation's founding and the Civil War. The Supreme Court, the White House, most of Congress. So they weren't an underdog. In many ways, they were the top dog.
Let me get Nick from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. And Nick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
I was just, you touched on it earlier, but I was really curious about what can current people fighting for social justice learn from John Brown's progressiveness and his bravery or courage in fighting for what he believed in.
Well, that's one of the essential questions about John Brown. Yes, go ahead.
I think it is interesting. I think he points up a few things. One, that fighting for social justice as he did is never easy or popular. We also forget today that abolitionists were a tiny minority in the North before the Civil War, and militant abolitionists like Brown were a tiny, tiny subset of that. So, you know, he does it also at great sacrifice to his family. This is not ever an easy thing to do. But I think it also makes us wonder what are the things today that we are blind to or failing to address that 20 years from now or 50 years from now, Americans will look back the way we do now at slavery and say, what were they thinking? So I think it requires courage and vision. One last thing, you know, he's 55 when he emerges as an abolitionist. It's never too late. I'm in my 50s now. And he forces you to think about your own life and what's possible.
Thanks for calling in, Nick. Let me see what Ed from Atlanta has to say. And Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
First, just want to say how much my wife and I enjoyed hearing you speak in Atlanta recently. And I'd like you to comment briefly on how you are not as much in this book as you have been in your previous wonderful books, Boys Long and Strange, Confederates in the Attic, mm-hmm. and so forth. Was that more of a conscious thing because of the seriousness of this topic or just the way it happened?
Mm-hmm. Fair enough, Ed. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, good question. My previous books have sort of mixed history with present-day travelogue, mixed travel journalism and history. And I was sorely tempted to do that this time. Strange things go on in Harper's Ferry, John Brown beard-growing contests, reenactments of his hanging. But I felt the story was so compelling and important that I didn't want to get in the way of it with my own adventures and antics in the present. And as you said, it's also a very serious. This is not a whimsical subject, and I thought it might confuse the tone. But also, I wanted to keep it a kind of taut, tense, sweaty narrative, true to the events, which are very dramatic in this several months period. And I didn't want to kind of break the spell by stepping out of the past and into the present.
But you also do a recreation, almost by a moment by moment, or it feels that way, mm-hmm. moment by moment recreation of what happens at Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, I want the reader really to be there as it's happening. Not sort of looking back. I don't quote history books in this. It's all primary sources. I just want to try and put you there because we're always looking back at history.
Yes.
And I wanted readers to be able to see it as Americans did at that moment, to experience it as they did. And that's another reason I didn't accept at the very beginning of the book, step out of the narrative.
There's a certain image I think a lot of people have. If they think of John Brown, they think of him with the beard and the sort of fiery eyes. Do you think that's an apt picture of who he really was?
Right. I think many Americans would be surprised to know that, yes, John Brown, we think of with that long, you know, prophet's beard, was actually for most of his life a well-groomed American on the make, a businessman, albeit not a very good one, who wore starched shirts and dark suits and leather cravats. And he only grew that famous scary beard of his in the last 18 months of his life when he had a price on his head and went underground and needed to disguise his identity.
And what happened to his family after he died? After he was hanged?
Yeah, his family is really shattered by this event. It's already been through a great deal of suffering and loss, but two of his sons die in the raid. One of them escapes. Brown, of course, hangs. So he leaves this trail of widows in upstate New York, where his family is centered at that point. One of his daughters is there at the mountain hideout with him, and one of his daughter-in-laws, and they're quite traumatized by what happens. So tremendous suffering. On the other hand, it brings his widow, in particular Mary, a degree of renown and even some financial support. People contribute to the John Brown Fund. They endured great tragedy, but they were still very proud of what he and the family had done.
You quote Louisa May Alcott. She says about John Brown, living, he made life beautiful. Dying made death divine.
Yeah, this was
part
of... Was
she getting a little carried away with herself, do you think?
This is part of this extraordinary outpouring of grief and admiration on the day of Brown's hanging, December 2nd, 1859. Bells are tolling across the North, and people are having church meetings, and thousands of people packing into these meetings, and people like Louisa May Alcott writing this rather over-the-top verse about he's Christ, and that's, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson declaring that he will make the gallows glorious like the cross. And one effect this has is to make Southerners go, oh my gosh, these people are deranged. They're all abolitionists. If they think this murderer and traitor is Christ, we are really enemies. So I think, again, it's part of that great divide that develops after the raid.
Do you feel like you really understand John Brown?
I think
all his motivations and demons, perhaps even.
Yeah, I would never claim to completely understand him, but I've been living and breathing this guy for 3 years, which isn't always an easy thing. As one historian put it to me, it's like being stuck in the Old Testament, and sometimes you want to get out. He's not always a warm and cuddly figure. But I think at this point, I wish I could beam back and interview him and ask him a few questions, but I feel I grasp the essence of him, or I hope I do.
What would you ask him?
One, what exactly did you intend? Was this a suicide mission? And if it wasn't, what were you thinking? Where were your plans? And, inevitably you would have to ask him about how he feels about a black president in America today. When he writes this constitution and has a constitutional convention of blacks in Canada, they nominate a black man for president in 1859. Mm-hmm. So here's Brown's dream fulfilled, but obviously we still have a long way to go. So I would be curious what his thoughts would be on our situation today.
Well, I would listen to that interview.
Yeah.
Tony Horwitz, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. And the book is called Midnight Rising, and it's subtitled John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. He is a writer. I should say our guest is a writer and won a Pulitzer Prize for journalism. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, the archives and email, and we have a picture of our guest on our Facebook page as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow, and we do want to close things out with Paul Robeson and an orchestra performing John Brown's Body, and this is a tune that was actually sung by Union troops during the Civil War that was commonly sung in honor of the abolitionist John Brown, but of course the lyrics I think are well known to people, and it also has a familiar tune, the Battle Hymn of the Republic in 1961. So let's listen to John Brown's Body.
Soap goes marching on. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Soul goes marching on. The stars above in heaven now are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven now are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven now are looking kindly down on the grave of old John Brown.